You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
A major redistricting case has made its way to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Again, the case has received national attention because Wisconsin's widely considered to have one of the most gerrymandered legislative maps in the country. The state Supreme Court heard oral arguments last week that set the stage for where the case might be headed. Our next guest has been following this story closely since the last time the maps were changed back in 2011. He joins us now for the latest. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the redistricting case? Do you think the state should redraw legislative maps now or wait until the next census, 10 years or so out? What would fair maps look like to you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sean Johnson is the Capital Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio. Sean, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob.
All right, this goes back a long way. You did a whole podcast, right, about this the last time around. Where to start with the story now, Sean? What is being challenged in this current lawsuit? Let's start there. Then we'll go back to the past.
Yeah, really. I mean, like, every map is built on the previous map, so we could just go back for decades and decades here. But I think we can get down to it. What's being challenged is the map or variation of the maps drawn by Republicans since they took control of the legislature in the 2010 election. And so they've had a couple versions of that, you know, the one they drew in 2011, the one they drew in 2021. But that big picture is what is being challenged here. And this time around, it's being challenged on some really kind of specific grounds. Mm-hmm. But big picture, that's what's at stake, is whether that map that has helped Republicans hold big majorities in the legislature in a state that's, you know, otherwise 50-50 politically or, you know, leaning Democrat in more recent elections, whether that map is allowed to stand or whether we get something to replace it.
Now, in that podcast mapped out, the story you traced had a lot to do with the partisan gerrymander of these maps. And that was what a lot of the legal challenges were about. This time around, I mean, that's what Democrats in particular and some others don't like about our maps. But what are the legal grounds in this case that just went before the state Supreme Court? It is not, as I understand it, the partisan lean of these maps.
It is not. You're correct. And so, you know, just kind of oversimplifying it, when you have a partisan gerrymandering case, the claim is that whoever drew the maps drew them in such a partisan way that it violated the constitutional rights of voters from the other party. How you define that, though, has been a challenge in the court system. The federal court system, under the direction of the U.S. Supreme Court, has said, we're just not going to deal with that anymore. That's non-justiciable. We're not going to take up partisan gerrymandering claims. You can take them up in state courts like the Wisconsin Supreme Court, but the Wisconsin Supreme Court decided not to hear a challenge to this map under a partisan gerrymandering claim. Instead, the court is looking at a couple issues, whether the maps drawn by Republicans violate the Constitution's requirement, the state Constitution's requirement that districts be contiguous, and whether or not there was a violation of the Constitution's guarantee of separation of powers in the way that the Supreme Court basically adopted this current map in 2022.
All right, let's talk about each of those. First of all, the contiguous thing. This is, let's talk about what that means. We do have districts where, when you look at the map, there are chunks, there are islands where you cannot walk from one district into the other. In some, you could boat from, I mean, one district into itself, another part of it, somewhere you could boat to stay in the same district. But there's another argument that contiguous means something different. What's the argument there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it boils down to whether you take contiguous under sort of the literal meaning, and what, you know, justices maybe assume that the framers of Wisconsin's state constitution were considering when they said contiguous, or whether you take the word contiguous in redistricting as it's been interpreted by courts and, you know, state lawmakers for the past, 30 to 50 years. So in, 1971, The legislature passed a law which provided for some wiggle room when it came to, you know, these islands of territory within a district. You know, they're not literal islands. They're pieces of territory from one district that are inside of another district. And then in the 90s, there was a federal court decision that basically endorsed that this was okay. And, you know, at the time you had the parties were arguing on different sides of the contiguous, or, you know, the contiguity and what that meant argument. But a federal court said, you can do this. And so there's sort of like the practical, here's what contiguous means in Wisconsin, the way we've been sort of doing things for the last few decades, or here's what contiguous means literally, the way that it's spelled out in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. So, you know, our state Supreme Court can decide kind of where to go with that.
And then the other grounds on this challenge before the state Supreme Court was process and separation of powers. This is a little bit subtle. Can you explain that to us?
Okay, so if you remember the last time, I don't know if you remember, it's redistricting is such a mess, and like you should really probably like think about other things in your life. But now, the last time around in the redistricting challenge, there the state Supreme Court, which was under control of conservatives at the time, told parties, we want you to draw a least changes map, you know, submit a map to the court. Since the legislature and the governor can't agree on a map in the political process, we want you to submit maps to the court that are your best stab at, a map that makes the fewest changes possible to the one that was passed by the legislature and signed by the governor back in 2011. So the governor did this. You had other parties do that. They submitted their least changes maps. The state legislature, run by Republicans, they didn't play the game. They submitted the map that passed the legislature and said, this is what we're submitting. This is a least changes map. We're done. That's not initially what the state Supreme Court chose, but the case was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court struck it down. And so it came back to Wisconsin, and the state Supreme Court basically endorsed the legislature's map. That was a lot there, I know. But
hang on, that map had been vetoed. Yeah, and that's where the challenge comes.
Exactly. So the problem, Democrats who are bringing this lawsuit argue, is that you had this map that didn't survive the political process. The legislature passed it. The governor vetoed it. The legislature didn't try to override the veto, even if we know practically that would have failed. They didn't do that step. And then the state Supreme Court came in and made it law anyway. And so Democrats are saying that's a violation of separation of powers. You can't come in, state Supreme Court, and just circumvent the political process here. It'd be one thing if the court had stepped in and drawn a new map. Courts do that, but that's not what they did. They endorsed a map that had been vetoed by the governor.
Talking to WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about the latest legal challenge to Wisconsin's voting maps, our redistricting system. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should those maps get redrawn before the next election or not? 800-642-1234 is the number. Okay, Sean, now that takes us to last Tuesday. What did some of the different justices on the court have to say to some of these arguments in the oral hearing here?
So you have conservative justices are in the minority now on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. You have a 4-3 liberal majority there. And so when Democrats, the attorney for the Democratic, petitioners got up and began to deliver oral arguments, one of the conservative justices, Rebecca Bradley, interrupted almost immediately and said, basically, I'll paraphrase here, but like, basically, aren't we just here because we had an election and the court changed? And she said that in so many words, a few times, basically, not really, it's a question, but it's also, she's making her point that this is, we're here because political circumstances have changed. And that's kind of an attempt to undercut the argument being made by Democrats. I would say, like, the lasting impression that I had among the liberal justices is they wanted to know how might we redraw maps if we did that. You know, a couple of them asked all the attorneys, say, like, if we did redo maps, who might you recommend? I mean, they're getting kind of specific there. Who in the country do you know that might be able to help us, a court, redraw maps? So, you know, I think it's fair to read into that line of questioning that they are considering that they might very well do that. And, you know, that would be a big deal.
On the other hand, Sean, so as I understand it, the plaintiffs, the Democratic-backed lawyers here, want the current maps redrawn. A remedy that they're looking for is a redo of the last elections. And I'm not a lawyer, you're not a lawyer. That seems like a long shot, and it didn't seem like even the liberal justices were eager to go there.
Yeah, they want... So right now in Wisconsin, you have 99 assembly districts. They're all up for election every 2 years. Then you have 33 Senate districts. Half of them are up in even years, half in odd years. And what Democrats are asking for in this case is that all of those Senate districts are up for election next year and all the assembly districts. So it would be a highly unusual step. It'd be a very dramatic step to basically erase, you know, the political influence of the previous map and say, we're going to go under a new map that is totally different. The argument being that the last one, or the current one that we're under right now, is unconstitutional. Justice Janet Protasiewicz, which is, you know, who is the justice who in her April election flipped the court from a conservative to a liberal majority. I think it's fair to say that we'll be kind of watching her comments during arguments in cases like these pretty closely for a while. She said that she described that or agreed with that being characterized as kind of an extreme remedy. So I don't know what that means in terms of what she would like to see or which argument she might adopt if she were to say the maps are unconstitutional. But that one at least did not sound like something she wanted to fully endorse on the spot right there.
Talking to Sean Johnson, WPR Capital Bureau Chief, co-creator of the Mapped Out podcast, with us today for a look at the latest on redistricting, including a state Supreme Court case hearing last week, a look at how we got here, what's at stake, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you hoping comes out of this? Do you want Wisconsin's legislative maps to be redrawn? Why or why not? Do you have questions about how all this works? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Sean Johnson, Capital Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio, about legislative maps in Wisconsin after a state Supreme Court hearing on the latest challenge to the current maps. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Jack is with us in Madison. Jack, hello.
Hi, Rob. How's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, a couple things. So first of all, I just wanted to say that when it comes to people who get creative and like to come up with new shapes for things, like, I love seeing people put that outlet into modern artwork or something abstract or minimalist like that, but I don't think the right outlet for that is on a legislative map. So you see people making weird shapes that just, there's no place for that, I think. But in all seriousness, you know, assuming the court does strike down the map soon and it's time to decide on how to reshape the districts, even though the Republicans were kind of floating it like a month ago, or Robin Voss tried to get something like that going, I wonder how likely it is that we'd adopt something like the Iowa nonpartisan redistricting model, which I am in favor of, by the way, but just making sure that that's all done with all parties at the table and the fairest process possible.
Jack, thanks a lot for the call. Sean, that did flare up along with this lawsuit. Speaker Voss, Republican leader in the Assembly, saying, yeah, we could do something kind of like that Iowa thing, but there was some pushback to that right away. Could you talk about whether that's a possibility?
I would just say that the bill that Republicans, or Speaker Voss, took up there with Iowa redistricting had a, a pretty substantial difference compared to previous versions of that bill in Wisconsin, in that it basically, the way that it's written, it would let the legislature reject the map a couple times and it just draw the map on its own if that were to happen. So the basic idea of, you know, the Iowa model redistricting is that you have a nonpartisan agency that draws maps and gives them, the legislature, an option for an up or down vote on them. In our case, it would be the Legislative Technology Services Bureau, the LTSB in Wisconsin, I believe, it's the Legislative Reference Bureau in Wisconsin that would draw the maps and present them to the legislature to vote on. But the way that the bill, the Republican bill, is written, you know, they'd get a couple cracks at it before the legislature would be able to kind of branch off on its own. And so you could have a situation where the current maps got approved again or something close to it. So I would say it's not exactly a pure version of the Iowa bill that's been talked about in the past.
Thanks for the call, Jack. Rob is with us now in Milwaukee. Rob, hello.
Hello. Yes, my comment is I'd like to see new maps. And I'd like to see the new maps bring about a election in the fall next year so we can get back to being a 50-50 state. That's my comment.
Rob, thanks a lot for the call. First of all, that notion you talked about, Sean, that plaintiffs were looking for here, that not half the Senate but all the Senate would be up for election again next fall. I want to get to the outcome here. Is there a thought that we would have maps that would give us something closer to a 50-50 legislature? There are geographical reasons for a Republican lean in a lot of potential maps.
Yeah, I mean, in the past, I've heard people who have called for redistricting reform. And I mean, the word reform is always in the eye of the beholder, but people who have said that, you know, the current maps are rigged and we need something different. We need fair maps. Even some of those voices have said, if you did that, you'd have a map that had a slight lean to Republicans because of the political geography of the state, the way that voters are spread out in Wisconsin. And, I don't think it's as pronounced as you sometimes hear it from Republicans, but obviously you have Democratic voters packed into Madison in Milwaukee far more densely than you have Republican voters packed into communities throughout the state. And so there is a potential for, you know, a Republican lean in a map. That's not to say that if the court stepped in and drew a map that it would have to look like that. They could draw a map that does, veer more toward a 50-50 map. It's all in the decisions that they make in terms of where the lines go. There are very smart and creative map drawers out there that would be willing to step to the plate and present something like that. Whether or not that ends up being a good thing, probably depends on, which party you're a part of and how it affects, your priorities.
Thanks a lot for that call, Rob. Sarah is with us now in Madison. Sarah, hi.
Hi. I was able to go down to the Capitol Tuesday morning when they were doing the opening arguments for the fair maps. And it was pretty obvious to me that Rebecca Bradley was extremely partisan. She interrupted the lawyers several times, and she wasn't talking about fair maps. She was talking about partisan maps. And I was kind of disappointed that a state Supreme Court justice was so partisan. But we want are fair maps. We don't want partisan maps, and we want every vote to count. And I find it interesting that we have a Democratic governor, but yet we can't seem to get any Democrats elected as representatives.
Sarah, thanks for that call. Sean, the perception of partisanship on the court, Sarah, definitely not alone in seeing Justice Rebecca Bradley as a outspoken conservative, but also attributing a partisan lean to all the justices. That just seems to be the way it is now.
Yeah, it does. I mean, there's not a whole lot of mystery anymore when the candidates run, especially when they embrace you know, help from the political parties to run their campaigns. And I think we often describe Rebecca Bradley as the court's most outspoken conservative. And she was definitely that during arguments in this case, came out right away and throughout the case. You know, very, very critical of petitioners, I think, would be an understatement.
Thanks a lot for that call. Sean, looking ahead, did the court give any kind of sense of a timeline? Like, okay, we heard your arguments, we're going to decide by blank?
They didn't give a timeline, but
they usually don't, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like they don't want to lock themselves in there, but petitioners want this all wrapped up by March so that you can have, you know, people circulate petitions to run in these new districts next year. And so I don't know if March would be when it happens, but March, April, I think would be probably that's kind of a deadline. Doesn't have to be, but I think that's something you'd be looking for just in terms of what the lawsuit is asking for. And I mean, it's a few months, but it's coming up pretty soon in terms of, it would really be a seismic change in Wisconsin. You know, this is not just a Republican map right now. I mean, Republicans are very close to having a veto proof majority in both houses of the legislature, 2/3 in both houses of the legislature, which would basically render the governor's office moot, you know, in some ways. The governor could no longer veto stuff he didn't like in the legislature. So they are very powerful right now, on the cusp of being far more powerful. And so, I mean, there's a reason Democrats have put a lot of urgency behind this case. It matters a lot to them.
Sean, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, Capital Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio, co-creator of the Mapped Out podcast. He joined us for updates on the redistricting case that made its way to the Wisconsin Supreme Court last week with oral arguments there, and a look at the past decade of battles over legislative maps here in the state and what's at stake. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, get more on this redistricting case, hear arguments on behalf of Democrats and on behalf of Republicans, and join in with your thoughts and your questions as well. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Here's a question for beer drinkers. If you order a beer and it comes with a lot of foam in it, do you send it back, ask for a top off, or just get annoyed? Things may be changing, and that foam may be part of the plan. The Washington Post reports that a lot of restaurants and bars around the country are embracing a foamy pour, which apparently is more common in Europe and a more traditional way to serve beer in many places. I'm interested in this because I learned over the years that I am not capable of pouring a low foam beer from a tap. A couple times I volunteered at those, you know, neighborhood block parties and festivals, including in the beer tent. I started off one time pouring beers. I was getting like 80% foam. Now, nobody wants that. Couldn't figure out what I was doing wrong. Other people use the same tap. No problem. I imitated them best I could. Still foam. It's like I had some kind of foam force field solution. I switched to the cash register. I worked retail for like 12 years. I am a rock star at making change. So it all worked out. A change may be brewing. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a look at why millennials are having fewer children and many opting to go child-free more than the generations that came before them. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about remembering our loved ones.
When someone is diagnosed with a terminal illness, how do we choose to preserve the memory of that person? Radio producer Alexandra Salmon and her mother-in-law, Chris Thomas of Madison, have always been close. When Chris was recently diagnosed with terminal cancer, Alexandra started recording some of their conversations. And on a perfect fall day, the two of them talked about Chris's lifelong connection to Wisconsin and what she hopes to leave behind.
I think I'm experiencing some of the sounds in my mind because they're sounds of little kids laughing and having fun. And that's, if I had had a woods like this near me, I would have been in it.
That's my mother-in-law, Chris Thomas. We're in the woods near her house in Madison, where she's thinking about putting her memorial bench. This little piece of wildness reminds her of another park she loved as a child.
It wasn't right near our house, but it was down at Westmoreland Park. And once I was old enough to have my freedom to go down there, it was really fun. I mean, we played in a woods like this. It was a little deeper and darker than this one, but kids just fantasize. They love having places like this to come to. And we hear kids down here giggling and, you know, playing, and it's really nice.
Chris is such a practical person, and she's always thought about putting other people first. The way she's approaching this memorial bench is no different. Can you just talk a little bit about this bench idea?
Well, it's certainly a copycatted idea all over the place. I mean, lots of people have benches, and I never thought of myself as somebody that wanted to mark my spot or be so impressive that I had a bench. I don't know why I thought about it, except that I like the fact that there are places for people to sit who, you know, people who might not walk this trail otherwise. If they knew there was a bench every so often, they might walk it more. And I think that's a good goal, to have something out here that people can actually utilize. So it's my little contribution to getting people out walking, you know, especially people that wouldn't do it otherwise.
Oh, what's this? Walnut?
Maybe. Yeah, it's hollow. Maybe from where we're standing, we look at what we're seeing. If I stand at a diagonal, I see that big tree, and that is the only really big tree right in there. And you know what? If we find another spot, fine, you know. But I kind of like this spot. It feels good. Yeah, I think along this trail, and the other trail would get used. But it'd just be sitting out along a trail. And this is so pretty in here.
Yeah.
So special. Yeah.
Well, and really, I do like those hidden benches.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like a surprise. You mm-hmm. come upon it, and then you think about who was this person.
Yeah. One winter when I walked in the arboretum a lot, I found a chrysalis or something hanging from a thread, and I watched that thing all winter, and then one day it was gone.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was audio producer Alexandra Salmon talking with her mother-in-law, Chris Thomas of Madison, about her memorial bench. Big thanks to Meeker and Maiden for letting us use their version of the song, Hills of Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, millennials, that's people born between 1981 and 1996, are having children at significantly lower rates than previous generations. According to Pew Research, as of 2018, about 55% of women between the ages of 22 and 37 had given birth. That was down 7% from Generation X, which is already down a little compared to baby boomers. And millennial women are also more likely to continue to remain childless throughout their childbearing years. So far, lots of millennial women are still in those childbearing years. We don't know yet whether they're just delaying having kids or aren't going to have them at all. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Are you a millennial? Do you plan to have children, or have you already had kids? Have you made a decision to delay it, put it off, or maybe not at all? And what is driving those decisions, or maybe those debates about whether to have kids? Or if you're watching your kids deciding whether to have kids, love to hear from you as well. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org.
Stephanie Kuntz is Director of Research and Public Education for the Council on Contemporary Families. She's the author of a lot of books on gender, family, and history, including the forthcoming For Better and Worse, The Problematic Past, and Uncertain Future of Marriage. Stephanie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
There are a number of ways to slice this question, but when you look at the data, Stephanie, what are you seeing when it comes to how many kids millennials are having, whether they're having at all?
Well, it is, as you say, too early to say, because the reproduction rates of women in their 40s have actually gone up. But of course, there is a biological limit. I think there are a lot of things going on here. First of all, people have to recognize that there's been a huge change over the past 80, 100 years in what kids mean. It used to be that having kids was an economic asset. You lived on a farm, you could do child labor. They've gradually become an economic sacrifice, especially having them early or having more than one or two. And people feel they have to save up for them. Women in particular feel they have to be set both educationally and occupationally. But at the same time, to the extent that they feel they're going to have to continue to work after the baby comes, they're very concerned about whether they're going to be able to balance those. And the old, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, if a society made it hard for women to combine work and family, they started having more babies. But today, it works exactly the opposite. The more a society makes it difficult for women to combine work and family, the more likely they are to reduce their family size or not have kids at all. And there's a really complicated list of reasons that people have for not having babies. But as of 2018, the gap between the number of kids women and men say they want to have and actually have reached had hit its highest level in 40 years. So there's something going on besides the fact, although this is an important fact too, that people do feel more socially acceptable to say, no, I don't want kids at all. A lot of people want them, but just don't think they can afford or risk having them or as many as they want.
Now, a lot of millennials came of age right on top of the Great Recession or soon thereafter, a really bad time to do things like enter the job market. How big a factor has that been, do you think, on millennials and having kids?
I think it's a huge effect. We saw a little rebound after the recession, but then we began to get these problems of college debt, increasingly precarious jobs, so that even people who make a good living while they're employed are more concerned about their future employment prospects. And of course, they're more concerned about their children's prospects, more concerned about having to send their child. And this leads to this intensive competitive parenting, which is stressful for both parents and the children. How can I get them into the best college possible? Because even college educated kids, some of them are falling behind. So there's all those sorts of pressures, that economic pressures that are going on. And then those combined with the fact that America has very, very poor social policies to allow you to combine work and family. So you feel like I'm going to have to keep working after I have the child. And yet it's so difficult to combine work with having a baby or a toddler that it's just a tremendous pull for women and for men.
Talking to Stephanie Kuntz with the Council on Contemporary Families about trends in how many kids people are having, down so far or delayed in many cases for millennials, digging into some of the reasons behind that. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Jason is with us in Chippewa Falls. Jason, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about?
I was just going to make comments on my wife and I, like one reason we haven't done it. You know, we want to, we well-educated individuals, we think we would be pretty good at raising a kid, but at the same time, we look at our finances, and I was lucky enough to buy a house in my 20s. So I'm like at the beginning of the whole millennial, maybe kind of grouped into millennials, mm-hmm. I think. And, you know, I was lucky enough to get a house in my 20s. And that mortgage is only like $500-$600 a month, but you look at our student loans and it's about $2,500 a month. And it's been that way for like 10 years. And you look at what it takes to get certain jobs. In my wife's case, physical therapist, but now you got to get a doctorate. Her education costs more than my home. And especially now, like, we're in our later 30s, and financially I think we could do it now, but, you know, in the past 2 years with these inflated costs, it's, I'm thinking the idea is going to sunset on us before we get the opportunity.
Jason, thank you so much for sharing that experience. Stephanie, illustrating one of the points you were just making, some people like Jason and his wife, looking at the household balance sheet, the numbers don't add up for them for having a kid.
Oh, that's right. There was a poll taken in 2018 of why people were putting off or not sure or deciding that they didn't want children. And 6 of the top 8 reasons were connected to this kind of economic thing. Worried about the economy, financial instability, needing to get more education or time on the job, but also childcare too expensive, no paid family leave, not enough leave. All of those kinds of things, there's a tremendous amount of concern about that. And it's a quite justifiable concern. You know, as a historian, I have to say, I am not at all nostalgic for the marriages of the 1950s and 60s because, or the gender relations, because they were extremely unfair. I mean, there were even things like marital rape was allowed. But I am nostalgic, and I understand a certain amount of nostalgia for the political and economic trends with the New Deal and Great Society and men's real wages rising all the time. So, you know, people, I think, are really feeling the pressure when it comes to thinking about what you're going to do with your kids in order to raise your own kids, and if, in fact, you have enough going on for you to be able to get your kids off to a good start.
Jason, thanks again for that call. Talking to Stephanie Kuntz with the Council on Contemporary Families, talking about why millennials, in many cases, are choosing not to have children or to delay having children as compared to previous generations. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a millennial, want to hear your thoughts on having kids, whether you're having them or not, if you're the parent of millennials or younger people, what are you seeing them talking about when it comes to whether or not you end up with grandkids? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Stephanie Kuntz, Director of Research and Public Education for the Council on Contemporary Families, looking at why millennials are having kids at lower rates than the generations before them, at least so far. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Millennials, want to hear about your thoughts on having children, whether you have them, would like to have them, or have decided not to. Join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Chris is with us in Wauwatosa. Chris, hi.
Hi, good evening. How are you doing?
Good. What's your story?
So I'm 36 years old. My wife is 33, and we have a one-year-old and are soon to have another one, probably a little sooner than we expected, in January. I'm working full time. I have a good job. She just finished her graduate degree right before we found out we were having our second, and we're really struggling with the idea of childcare. Now, it right now doesn't make sense for her to go to work, even though she has a graduate level degree, due to the cost of childcare. And that's really hampering our ability to even consider a third. So I think, just, you know, from a millennial standpoint, you know, childcare, other than having grandparents watch them, is really a deterrent for having additional children or children in general.
Chris, thanks a lot for that call. Stephanie, a lot of people, myself and my wife included at various points, have had to weigh the is it worth it to work given the cost of childcare situation that hasn't changed in the last 20 years or so. How big a factor is this?
Oh, I think it's quite a big factor. And the problem is that it creates a real double bind because in the short run, it's obviously a very convenient way and often a necessary way to deal with the stress of work and family life. On the other hand, in the long run, it really hurts women's future in the workforce, and it inhibits male participation at home. I was really glad to hear that your callers, your first two callers were male, because one of the important things we find in women's decisions or willingness to have children is how important paternal leaves and paternal attitudes are. That employed women are more likely to have a second and a third child if their partner was able to share child-rearing duties. And they didn't have to completely sacrifice work in order to build their family. So that's another important consideration.
Chris, thanks for the call. Good luck in figuring all that out. Before we go back to our callers, Stephanie, how much can things like public policy, social programs, things like that, a lot of countries around the world are trying various efforts to make it easier for people to have kids. Do we know if anything actually works?
Well, there was a somewhat re-increase in fertility in the late 90s and the first 7 or 8 years of the 21st century in several countries that did initiate better programs for childcare and maternity leave and paternity leave, which seems to be extremely important, as I said. There are limits, though. I mean, I think there are limits in terms of how much we can expect to increase fertility to older rates in a world where we want to spend this much time with our kids, when it takes so much long to reach educational and economic maturity. And perhaps we need to also start thinking about, you know, what do we really have to have an economy that depends upon constantly expanding the market? Or are there other ways that we can begin to utilize our natural and our people resources?
Let's go back to our callers. Mark is with us in Eau Claire. Mark, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
I just wanted to share how my wife and I go about it. And we're both 27 and 28. She's just a little older than I am. And after we bought our first house, we waited about a year, and we actually ended up fostering a son first. And we still plan on having some kids of our own. But I've just been a little more curious every time I hear the conversation, if there's more of a correlation between when millennials buy our first houses and then start having kids, or if it's, you know, related to more and more people that just don't buy a house and continue to rent for a longer time.
Mark, thanks for the call, and thank you for serving as a foster parent. By the way, Stephanie, a home buying, having a secure home, and making that decision to have kids, how big a factor is that?
Well, I don't have exact data on that, but of course it's a huge factor. I mean, you just look at, I got my first grandchild this over the COVID period. And by the way, there was an interesting bump in fertility rates of American-born women during COVID, which suggests that the opportunity to work from home and the kind of income supports that were in place may have an impact on people's decision. But certainly, if you can't afford to buy a house, if you're worried about your mortgage payments might not be able to make them, you could be foreclosed, that's a very risky situation to bring a child into the world with.
Thanks again for that call, Mark. Stephanie, another stat I wanted to touch on. In one Pew survey, they ask in different ways about people's attitudes toward kids. And one of them, they're asking for people who don't have kids. A little over half of them surveyed said it was simply because they didn't want children. We've talked about a lot of the economic factors here. You touched on it briefly earlier. How big a factor is people don't necessarily feel that social pressure that having kids is just what you do?
Well, I think that's very important that people do feel free to say, I choose not to have kids, just as which was just in the 1950s, you were really looked down upon. It was a real social stigma to admit that you didn't want to have kids. On the other hand, when we actually look at the complex of reasons why people say they don't want kids, it gets more complicated. There was a New York Times poll that gave people a lot of choices. The biggest number was the childcare is too expensive. Then was want more time for the children I already have, can't afford children, financial instability, then want more leisure time, worried about global instability, 35% struggle with work-life, family, and even almost a third were worried about the environmental crisis. So there's a lot of things going on. And I think most people are really more ambivalent about this, and they can be tipped by the economic stresses, the social stresses, and their worries about the future of American democracy and the American economy.
Stephanie, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Stephanie Kuntz, Director of Research and Public Education for the Council on Contemporary Families, author of a bunch of books on gender, family, and history, including the forthcoming For Better and Worse, The Problematic Past and Uncertain Future of Marriage. She talked to us about why millennials are less likely to have kids than previous generations. Probably have her back to talk about that book when it comes out. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, UW System schools have announced layoffs and employee buyouts lately. What does that mean for students? We'll check in with college students from around the state. And an international program with strong roots in Wisconsin is getting women involved in more outdoor activities. We'll find out about the Becoming an Outdoors Woman project tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, find out why facial recognition systems are on the rise and what it all means for our privacy with the author of the new book, Your Face Belongs to Us. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.